Here we are halfway through the year made famous by Back to the Future Part 2, and it's the 30th anniversary of the original film, which explains the timing of the new book by Cassine Gaines, We Don't Need Roads, the making of the Back to the Future trilogy. Thanks for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, this is a book. It's not a book if you want to find out the real detail. I mean, the intricate stuff like how Twin Pines Mall got changed to Lone Pine. But we do get to find out the struggles in getting the film made in the first place. Like, big time struggle of personalities. We got the studio boss, the godlike executive producer, and the director producers. These are all guys that seem to be at odds with each other throughout the making of the movies.
Yeah, it's a real character-driven story, I think. You know, I was really interested in looking at the making of the Back to the Future trilogy through the eyes of the filmmakers. They're real people. They're humans. They made mistakes. They had disagreements. They had challenges. And so I wanted to look at this amazing pop culture phenomenon, not only what decisions were made, but also sort of how those decisions were made.
Well, let's talk with just the title of the movie. The studio boss wanted something, what, Spaceman from Mars or something?
From Pluto, yeah. Sid Sheinberg, the executive in charge from Universal, had the idea. He didn't really understand the title, Back to the Future. He said, how can you go back to the future? That doesn't make any sense. And of course, that's the point. That's why it's such a great title. But he was advocating that the movie be renamed Spaceman from Pluto. And when Bob Zemeckis, the director, received this memo, he started to freak out and didn't know how he was going to address it. Steven Spielberg, the executive producer, said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. And he fired back a memo to Sid Sheinberg, thanking Sid for the very funny joke and saying that everyone got a good laugh out of it. And Sid Sheinberg was so embarrassed that he didn't have the heart to say that he was serious. And so Back to the Future remained as the title.
Now, we should say that Sheinberg did get his way, at least on one point. That's why Lorraine McFly is Lorraine, right?
Yes. Originally, the character had a different name, and Lorraine is the name of Sid Sheinberg's wife. And so he requested, you know, if it was all the same to the screenwriters, you know, why don't you just change the name of the female protagonist? And so they made that change for him.
Now, we should talk about the screenwriters, Robert Zemeckis, who was a director, and also Bob Gale. I mean, these guys, especially Bob Gale, did so much with these three movies. I remember, you know, watching these movies, if you go back to their earlier films, I mean, you talk about this. There were three films in particular, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Used Cars, and 1941. A lot of those three movies, a lot of what you see there, ends up in the three Back to the Future movies.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I asked Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale was, do you think Back to the Future would have turned out as well if it was your first or second film? And they all said no. They learned things in writing 1941 and making Used Cars and I Want to Hold Your Hand that helped them when it came time to Back to the Future. In terms of how to tell a good story, there's so many things in Back to the Future that you see in the first third of the film that are paid off in the later portions of the film. And those are skills that were developed. And of course, just sort of the sense of humor that's in those films, that's sort of consistent. There's a manic energy that's present in all of their early films, and it radiates through the Back to the Future trilogy as well.
Now, one of the things that I find amazing about the three movies today is that they are so popular. Everybody just loves them. And people really look to that second movie that goes 30 years into what is now our present day. And people just got really nuts about the hoverboards. What's that all about? I mean, come on, flying cars, so much more important, I would think, than hoverboards.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, you know. I don't know how eager I am to get on a hoverboard if they ever exist. I'm a pretty clumsy person, so I'd probably fall off one. But yeah, the hoverboards just captured everyone's imagination from even before the film was out. There was a making of television special that aired the weekend before the film hit theaters, and Universal was bombarded with telephone calls from parents wanting to know where they could get their kids a hoverboard. And Robert Zemeckis, in a very tongue-in-cheek interview, said that hoverboards were real and that they had been kept off the shelves by parents' rights groups. And so, you know, parents and kids took that as gospel, which of course wasn't true. But it doesn't seem like a week can go by without someone claiming to have invented the first real hoverboard. Will we ever see that technology really? Who knows? But it's amazing that for 25 years after the second film, people are still waiting for some of those predictions to come true.
Now, let's talk about some of the actors. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the casting of the main characters, absolutely perfect, but it was not, from what we read in the book, didn't happen perfectly. Like Michael J. Fox, not the original choice, and Crispin Glover, who was an original choice. There were some real problems with getting the actors and keeping them.
Yeah, Michael J. Fox was always the first choice, but he wasn't the first pick. He was unavailable because he was filming Family Ties. And so they ended up hiring Eric Stoltz. And Eric Stoltz, who's a very good actor, and everyone was, you know, there were no disagreements about that. He just wasn't right for Marty McFly. He wasn't really a broad comedic actor. He wasn't really clicking as well with the other performers on screen. And so after filming 6 weeks, they fired Eric Stoltz, which was a completely unprecedented move, and a move that took a little bit of maneuvering that's outlined in the book. But also, as you mentioned, Crispin Glover, who was sort of an eccentric figure on the set of the first film, did not return for the sequels. Their contract negotiations stalled, where Crispin Glover wanted more money than the producers, frankly, were going to give him. And because of sort of ongoing irritations, Bob Gale kept writing George McFly, his character's role, to have less and less import to the movie. So that didn't end up working out. And there were some other minor casting changes throughout, too, that were the result of those two major ones.
Yeah, I mean, in this first and second movie, the character of Jennifer, Marty McFly's girlfriend, changes from, was it Claudia Wells to Elizabeth Shue?
Yeah, and that was actually, unlike the Eric Stoltz situation or the situation with Crispin Glover, that was really one where everyone wanted Claudia Wells to come back, and Claudia Wells wanted to come back, but her mother was diagnosed with cancer and was very, very ill at the time, and her priority was to her family, which is certainly understandable, and so they had to replace her as well.
So let me ask you a personal question here. You've got this great book out called We Don't Need Roads, The Making of the Back to the Future Trilogy. Now, when I saw the film, I was a mostly formed adult when it came out back in 85. And I mean, I remember the 50s from actually being there. However, you were born when?
In 1986. So
okay.
I was born actually a year after the first film came out.
So what brought you to this film? Why do you love it so much enough to write a book about it?
You know, I've always had sort of an interest and fascination with the 50s. I mean, I grew up watching Leave It to Beaver and watching Dennis the Menace and watching, you know, lots of old black and white shows on TV. So that time period, you know, as a kid, seeing the Back to the Future trilogy on VHS, probably around 1991 was the first time I saw all three films. I just loved that they revisit the 1950s. I thought DeLoreans were the coolest thing. I recognized a lot of those actors from other movies or TV shows. And also, you know, everyone, even if you're a child, wonders what your parents must have been like when they were your age, when they were a kid. And so I love that I had the ability to sort of have this wish fulfillment, or at least have my curiosity quenched through watching these films. And they're just so fun to watch. You know, even as a child, you know that Marty McFly is the coolest guy and Doc Brown is crazy and the car is awesome and they're going fast and Biff is a jerk. It's storytelling that you can appreciate if you lived through the 1950s, and even if you're 4 or 5 years old seeing it for the first time, you can appreciate it too. And that's really, I think, why the Back to the Future trilogy has endured, not just in the United States, but around the world. It's really great storytelling that can be appreciated on a number of different levels.
And it must have messed up so many young minds as well to see this kid go back to 1955, interact with his mother, who has the hots for him all of a sudden. That's got to be weird.
Yeah, I think as a kid, I don't know if I realized how weird it was, but for Bob Zemeckis, he said during the first test screening, when the audience laughed during the line, "Kissing you is like kissing my brother," he said, "Okay, the movie's going to be okay. Everyone gets that. You know, we're not going into tawdry territory here." And so it was all right.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us. Cassine Gaines, who has a new book out called We Don't Need Roads. You like the way I put the pause in there? We Don't Need Roads.
I do. I got it.
Okay. The Making of the Back to the Future trilogy. Thanks very much for spending the time with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And for Around Cincinnati, I'm Frank Johnson.